allowed for 15 multiples. You'll have to decide which one to pick. And maybe you'll have to do the regressions before you pay. What's your ultimate job? It's to tell me what the five cheapest and the five most expensive are, right? So you want to pick a multiple that gives you the best chance of getting it. So along the way, you'll have to make choices as to which multiple is going to give you the best chance of finding the five cheapest and the five most expensive. The regression is only a tool. It's not going to tell you what to do, right? So ultimately, the regression is not what's driving this process. It's you. Yeah? That's one of the things you can look at. The higher the R squared, the more the tighter your prediction. Right? Right? But if you have a low R squared, you can be far away from the line, but you can still be within the bounds. Remember the two outer lines that I drew? The higher the R squared, the tighter the bounds become. So if you have a really low R squared, the bounds will get really wide. So even though you look like you're far away from the line because your R squared is low, you can't reject the hypothesis that this stock is cheap and expensive. That's why you want a higher R squared over a lower R squared. It could be that the R is low, that multiple tells you nothing about cheaper expenses. Even abandoned. That's why I said you might have to do the regression before you pick the multiple. You can't pick the multiple and then do the regression, because the multiple you pick might have a really low R squared. So it's a pragmatic exercise. There is no right multiple. I can't tell you this is the right multiple, because depending on the data set, one multiple might work better than another. And the only way to find out is to try lots of it. Right. Whatever you want. You want a proxy for future growth. Ultimately, if you look at the equation, it's all about future growth. If you tell me last year's growth is a good predictor of future growth, then you can use last year's growth. Not growth of a... Yeah, because ultimately your focus is on future growth. You're looking for proxies for future growth, proxies for future risk, proxies for future return. Right. That's why you might decide to use the last 5 years of growth rate as the best predictor. Somebody else might say, hey, that's not a good predictor of future growth. I'm going to use the analyst estimate for future growth. Don't let the statistics drive the process. Right? It's just a tool that you need to use. So ultimately, the decision is going to be yours. Okay. Yeah. Okay, folks. So how is the mystery project coming? I'm glad you're saying, what mystery project, right? You're learning to wrestle with the data. And let me explain what I mean by wrestling with the data. You have 200 companies, you have all this data, you start putting the data together, and the data never behaves the way you want it to behave. You know what I mean by that? You know, you have all these things in your head about what's supposed to happen, but the data says, no, that's not what's going to happen. And what I said last session, I'm going to say again, don't fight the data. Pricing is a pragmatic exercise. It's an exercise about finding what's cheap and expensive. Use the tools that you have. Use statistics as a tool. Use multiples as a tool. Use those equations you had looked at as a tool. But they're all tools. Ultimately, if you go back and look at the project description, I say, find me the five cheapest and the five most expensive, And that's all I care about. So how you get there is what I'm looking at. Because ultimately, I don't know what the five cheapest and the five most expensive are. You don't. So I want to see whether the process you've used makes sense. It's due a week from today by 5 o'clock. So, you know, if you haven't started working on it, it's time to start working on it. If you are working on it, you know, don't let yourself diverge from an answer. Converge on an answer. So today we're actually going to switch gears. We've talked about intrinsic valuation. We've talked about pricing. And today we're going to take a detour into what's called asset-based valuation. You're saying, what the heck is that? If you think about discounted cash flow valuation, it's all driven by earnings and cash flows, right? So when you project out earnings and cash flows, you take the cash flows, you discount them back, you come up with a value. That's intrinsic valuation. In pricing, you look at multiples of things, multiples of earnings, multiples of book value, multiples of revenues. Today, we're actually going to go look at the company's balance sheet and value the company by valuing its individual assets. Okay? You're saying, what is that even going to mean? Let me start off with a couple of start-of-the-class questions as to see where this is going to take us. So in a DCF valuation, you take expected cash flows, you discount them back at a consolidated cost of capital, you come up with the present value, you get the value of the business. In asset-based valuation, you value the pieces of the business. So let me make this very specific. I could take Disney, project out the cash flows for Disney as a company, discount back at Disney's cost of capital and value Disney, which is the way I've approached DCF so far. Here's the other way I could value Disney. I could value ESPN separately. I could value, you know, ABC broadcast. Basically, I could take each slice of Disney, the theme parks, the movies, Pixar, Marvel, value them each individually and add them all up. And I'll come up with a value for Disney. Which approach is going to give me the more precise answer? Consolidating and discounting back at a consolidated cost of capital, or taking each slice of the business and making my specific assumptions about each slice and valuing it separately? Taking each slice and valuing it separately clearly will give me a more precise answer. So you're saying, why haven't we done that right from the beginning? Well, I need a lot more information to value each slice, right? To value ESPN, what do I need to know? I need to know the earnings of ESPN, the cash flows of ESPN, the capex of ESPN, the depreciation for ESPN. And guess what? It's all lost in the mix. The reason we tend to value companies as consolidated entities is because we don't have the information to value them in pieces. So today's session is about dealing with that limited information you're given and what you get. Now, one of the benefits you're going to get when you value companies by summing up the assets is you get what's called a sum of the parts valuation. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that today because a lot of analysts use this word, sum of the parts, and I'm going to talk about what they mean when they say that. Let's assume that you are interested in buying a company to break it up. You're saying, why would I want to do that? That's what a lot of activist investors do. In fact, Sony's been targeted for the last few years by investors who want to buy the company, break it up into pieces. So let's say you're that investor, you're looking at a company. You value the company as the sum of its parts, and you value the company as a consolidated company. For this to be a good candidate, so I'm going to ask you the easy part of the question first. For this to be a good candidate for you to break up, what's got to be true about the valuation? Should the sum of the parts value, the value of the sum of the parts be less than, equal to, or greater than what you get for the value of the consolidated company? I told you this is the easy part, so don't look for tricks. What do you want to be true? You want to break it up, the sum of the parts valuation has to be greater than the value of the consolidated company. Now it comes a deeper question. Why would that ever happen? Why would Disney ever sell as less than the sum of its parts? What are some of the reasons it could happen? Yes? And why might that be? When the assets come together, first, who's valuing them? The market is. So maybe the market's making a mistake. Maybe it doesn't see a very valuable part of the business because it's all mixed together and the market's really confused. So one might be a pricing mistake. What else? It could be that you combine all these businesses together in one company. The company is badly managed. It permeates and affects all those businesses. In fact, in academic finance, there is this finding called the conglomerate discount. Have you heard about this? Basically, that conglomerates, which are mixes of businesses, trade at a 5, 7, 10% discount on the pieces that go into the business. And there are lots of reasons that are thrown around. And one might be that when you combine companies into this business, they become less efficient. They run less efficiently. So one of the things we're going to talk about is how do we find companies like those? How do we decide that Sony is a good candidate for the sum of the parts? How would you value the sum of the parts of a company to decide that this is a company you want to target to break up? So let's go back and complete the last few pieces of pricing, and then we'll jump into some of the parts valuation. So I'm going to start with something today that might actually be very close to what you might be struggling with on your mystery project. I gave you 200 companies. I gave you, 100 raw data items? You can compute all kinds of multiples, right? Current PE, trailing PE, forward PE, EV to EBITDA, EV to forward EBITDA. My guess is you can compute 30 different multiples for your company. You're sitting there looking at these 30 multiples and say, which one should we use? There are three things you can do. One is you can use all 30 and come up with this pricing with each one and take a simple average. Is that a good idea, you think? Try PE, then price to book, then price to sales. Well, simple average means you're taking the good stuff, the bad stuff, throwing them all into the mix and saying, no, let it go. Don't do that, please. The second is you can try to be sophisticated and say, I'm not going to throw away any of the 30, but I'm going to take a weighted average of the 30. Weighted by what? By how precise each multiple is. And we'll talk about how to come up with measures of precision. You can try that. It's very messy, very complicated. I think the best thing to do is to actually pick one of those 30 multiples. You're saying, which one? That's going to be what I want to talk about next, is you have to pick one of the 30. Should it be PE, price to book, EV to EBITDA? There is no right answer that's going to apply across all groupings and all companies. So let's talk about how to decide which multiple to pick. And this is not just for your mystery project. It's also going to be for pricing your regular company as part of your bigger project. Here are the three choices. I'll give you the cynical answer first. Pick the multiple that makes your life easiest. With your big project, you've already done your DCF, right? Say yes, even though you might not have. Yes, you got a DCF. You got a valuation for your company. You found your company to be either undervalued or overvalued. So let's say you found your company to be undervalued. You're now in the pricing portion of the project, and I ask you to price the company. What would you like to find in your pricing that's going to make your final project report nice and clean and tightly written? So when you do your pricing, you compare your stock to the sector and you say, my stock is underpriced, overpriced. You already found your company to be undervalued. You want to have a lot of oomph behind your final recommendation. You'd like to find your stock to also be underpriced. So the cynical answer is find the multiple that kind of matches up to your story. That way you can tell me at the end, not only is my company undervalued, but it's also underpriced. Look, I have the proof for it. The reason I throw that cynical answer out at you is all too often you're on the receiving end of an analyst telling you this stock is cheap based on the PE ratio, EV to EBITDA. Think about how they ended up with that multiple. It wasn't accidental. They picked a multiple that best fits their story. So the reality is a lot of multiples are chosen because it best fits the story. That's not going to work with your mystery project because you don't have a story yet, right? You don't even know what's cheap or what's expensive. The second is, use the multiple, think like a mathematician. Think like, so you're saying, look, I want the multiple that best explains what's going on in this sector, in this group. How will you find it? You take the 30 multiples, you run regressions, maybe not on all 30, but on 10 or 12 or 15. You pick the multiple that has the highest R-squared. And what's the advantage of having a high R-squared? Is your predictions are much more precise, right? So when you tell me something is cheap with that multiple, you feel much more confident about your conclusion. You pick the multiple with the highest R-squared and say, that's the multiple I'm going to pick because it has the best predictive power. Or there's a third way you can pick a multiple. And it's more intuitive and it works especially when you're working within a sector. Pick the multiple that makes the most sense for that sector. You think, how would I know what that is? Put yourself in the shoes of managers in that sector and think about what they focus on. And once you can figure out what they focus on, you can reverse engineer what kind of multiple best works in that sector. Let's take an example. If you've ever tracked retailers, JCPenney, Macy's, even Amazon, but especially the brick and mortar retailers, there are two numbers that in every quarterly report they will emphasize. One is same store sales. Basically, they'll tell you our same store sales went up by 3%. To basically give you a sense of, hey, if you're growing and you're adding more stores, it's less efficient than having our existing stores grow their sales at 8, 10, or 15%. Same store sales. And the second number retailers focus on with almost laser-like precision is margins. They keep talking about margins. If you're in a business where margins are the dominant variable, the multiple that makes the most sense is the multiple that's driven primarily by margins, which is revenue multiples. So if you're looking at retailers, revenue multiples will tend to be widely used simply because the focus on margins makes revenue multiples much more intuitive. If you go to financial service companies, banks, insurance companies, investment banks, there's a lot of talk of return on equity, or how to increase return on equity. If you're focused on return on equity, the multiple that makes the most sense is a price-to-book ratio. If you go into technology companies, there's a lot of talk about growth. The multiple that makes the most sense is price-earnings ratio. You tell me what you're focused on in a sector, I'll tell you which multiple works best in that sector. So when you look at picking the right multiple, don't look for one answer to fit all. It really has to be customized to what your task is and what kind of sample you're looking at. So I'll close this section off by giving you some empirical evidence. Remember those 550 equity research reports I talked about at the very start of this process? I actually went through the equity research reports and I started looking for what kind of multiples showed up in which sectors. So I was looking for what do analysts actually use in different sectors. And this is what I found. I'm not saying these are the right multiples. These are the multiples I tended to see in each sector. When I looked at cyclical manufacturing companies, automobiles, steel, etc., I saw a lot of P/E ratios using what's called normalized earnings. Sounds fancy, but they take average earnings across a cycle, and they said this company looks cheap because it's trading at 5 times average earnings over the last 5 years. When I looked at young growth firms, a lot of PEG ratios, because that, at least in their minds, meant that they were controlling for growth. When I looked at young growth firms with losses, like social media companies, a lot of revenue multiples. Why? Because that's the only number that was positive. With infrastructure companies, cable, cellular, telecom, a lot of EBITDA multiples. Why? Because the depreciation was enough to make your losses into profits. With real estate investment trusts, this is the only sector where this is true. I saw a lot of cash earnings, which is net income with depreciation added back. The reason being that real estate has a lot of depreciation it throws off. It saves you a lot in taxes. So a lot of cash earnings. Financial service companies, a lot of price to book equity. And finally, for retailing, a lot of revenue multiples. Again, I'm not saying these are the multiples you should be using if you have a retail company, but this is what analysts tend to use within each sector. So let's finish this whole process off. Let's say that you've done your DCF, you've come up with the value, you've followed every rule in the book, you've done this right. You do a pricing for your company, you've done everything right. You pick the right sector, you control for everything, you price the company. So you've got an intrinsic value for your company, you've got a price for your company. We've kind of answered this question, but let's answer it again. Are you going to get the same number for your company using both approaches? Not necessarily, right? Even though you've done everything right, you've answered two different questions. One is, what is the value of my company? The other is, what is the price of this company? If you lived in an efficient market, then the value and the price should be about the same. But we don't live in efficient markets. The pricing process is driven by very different variables than the value process. You've been seeing what happened to United stock price yesterday? You drag one guy off a plane, you lost $1 billion in value. What's the total value of United? They might be 39 people away from going to a value of zero. 39 billion, drag one person off every day for the next 39 days, you'll be down to zero. That's a pricing impact. Is the value of United dropped by $1 billion because one guy got dragged off? I don't know. The only way to answer it is to work out the long-term consequences. And there might be long-term consequences because already you're talking about legislation directed primarily at United. Who knows what's coming down the pike? But that's the difference between the pricing game and the value game. The pricing game is driven by mood and momentum. And yesterday, the mood and momentum was all against United. So price versus value. So let's say you come up with this value, you come up with the price, the numbers are different for your company. You have to make a recommendation, right? Buy or sell. So here's my final question, and there is no right answer to this question because it depends on lots of different things that are specific to you. So I want you to look inward and tell me what you're going to base your buy or sell on. I know you don't have the numbers yet, but you have an intrinsic value, you've got a price. They're different numbers, and let's say that they give you different answers. One says buy and the other says sell. I'm going to ask you how you're going to base your recommendation. Should you base your recommendation on intrinsic value? Because after all, you spend all the time on the DCF. Should you base it on pricing? Should you base it on some kind of composite of the two? You know what I mean by composite of the two? Your DCF value is 50. Your pricing is 25. You take 50 plus 25 and come up with some number in the middle. Okay? The higher of the two values, maybe because you're an optimist, or lower of the two values because you're conservative, or does it depend on what your mission is, what game you're playing? How many of you pick intrinsic value as your basis for your recommendation? Nobody? So why did you do your DCFs? If you base it on value, what are you saying? I have a long time horizon, I'm willing to wait, and ultimately what's going to happen? I think the price, it's faith. Faith in your value, faith in the market. If you base it on pricing, what are you saying? I don't care what the value is. I'm playing the pricing game, and I'm essentially going, if I'm right in the pricing game, I'm going to sell at a higher price. Who cares what the value is? So if you're playing the pricing game with Tesla, it's at $300 per share. The mood and momentum is all in its favor. You say, I don't care if the value is 260 or 240 or 220. I'm buying at 300. I'm selling at 350. I'm going to make a profit anyway. It's a pricing game. I'm okay with either game. You know what I'm not okay with? You're trying to combine the two. Because then you're trying to play two philosophically different games. You'd be amazed at how many IPO valuations I see where investment bankers will tell you the DCF value, then they'll say PE ratio gave me this number, price to book gave me this number, EV to EBITDA gave me this number. I'm going to add up the four numbers, divide by four, and give you what the value of the stock is. That's like saying that you'll be Buddhist for the first half of the day and Muslim for the second half of the day. It doesn't work. There is the dividing line where you have to decide. You're philosophically playing two different games here, and you can't combine those two games. So let's review. When you look at a multiple, start off by defining the multiple, right? And when you define the multiple, make sure, and this is about your mystery project. So all those multiples you're doing, make sure those multiples are consistently defined. And remind me again what consistent definition means, what's got to be true. If the numerator is an equity value, denominator has to be an equity value as well. If your numerator is enterprise value and you have minority interest, make sure you clean up for them. Consistency is the first step. Second, look at the data. Before you start using any of these multiples, you have 200 companies, you have the EV to EBITDA, just put it down on a graph. Draw a histogram. Get a sense of what's high or low before you start using a multiple. Then analyze the multiple. That's why we did that algebra with the discounted cash flow models. Not because we want to use those models, because it tells us what we should be controlling for. And then apply the multiple. And that's where regressions, all those tools we talked about, come in at that stage of the process. You need to keep that in perspective as you go through. Your regressions are not picking your five cheapest and your five most expensive stocks. You are. The regression works for you, not the other way around. So pricing is actually very simple if you keep it all about pricing, right? Basically, you're trying to find out what the market would pay for something like your company. So now let's talk about valuing the assets of a company. Right? There are three reasons why you might have to do asset-based valuation. The first is you might be interested in doing a liquidation valuation of your company. You think, why would I want to do that? You might have no choice. Your company might be in so much trouble, you might have to liquidate your company. You heard of the troubles that Toshiba is going through right now? Toshiba, of course, Japanese company, has been around forever. The problem started when it bought Westinghouse for its nuclear power technology about 10 years ago. The whole thing's blown up in them. They're in so much trouble that there is talk that you might have to liquidate the company. What does that mean? Toshiba is in 15, 20 different businesses. Liquidation basically means asking how much you will get for each business. Or if you're valuing Valiant right now, you might say, look, there's no point running this company anymore. I'm going to liquidate the company. I'm going to sell off Salix. I'm going to sell off each piece of the company for whatever I can get. You have to do an asset-based valuation. It could be that you've had the unfortunate job of becoming an accountant. And your job is to do fair value accounting. What's fair value accounting? Basically, you take every asset on the balance sheet and bring it up to what you think of it. You have no choice but to do asset-based valuation. Or the third place you might have to do asset-based valuation is because you're an investor, like a Carl Icahn or a Bill Ackman, interested in breaking up companies. So you want to do a sum of the parts valuation. So let me do a very quick visit to liquidation valuation and accounting valuation, and then we'll spend more time on the sum of the parts valuation, which is really where you can get your hands dirty. So let's start with when it's going to be easiest to do asset-based valuation. So think about what you're doing in asset-based valuation. You're taking each asset and trying to put a value on it. It's going to be easiest to do, if you're talking about intrinsic, so if you think about putting a number on it, you can use any of the approaches we've talked about so far. You can do an intrinsic value of every asset, right? Project the cash flows, discount back at the cost of capital. You can do a pricing of every asset. What does that mean? You take every asset and you say, what would I be willing to be able to get in the market for it? Or you can trust the accountants and use the book value. So basically, you can do an intrinsic value, you can do a pricing, or you can use a book value. And if you think about what kinds of companies this is going to be easiest to do in, here are the things you're going to look for. The first is, it's nice to have a company with separable assets. Like what? Let's say you have a real estate company which has 5 real estate holdings in New York. Some of the parts valuation is going to be really simple, right? Take each holding, value it separately. So the Fifth Avenue building you own, the downtown building you own, can each be valued separately. As opposed to what? Remember I told you we were going to try to value Disney as a sum of the parts valuation? The biggest problem you're going to face is if you try to value the theme park standing alone. What's the problem you're going to face? The movie business for Disney spills over into the theme park business, right? So if Disney has a very successful, when Frozen was, you know, when they produced Frozen, Frozen made almost $1 billion at the movie theaters. But it also created rides in the theme parks that allowed the theme parks to make more money. More people came to theme parks because they saw Frozen. So if I told you the value of Disney theme parks is X billion, I might be missing the fact that there's a spillover effect. So when I talk about separable assets, I'm talking about assets that stand alone and produce their own earnings and cash flows. Second, it'd be nice if each of those separable assets told me what they made as earnings or cash flows. That's why buildings are so easy to value standing alone. If I have a rental building, I know exactly how much income I make on that building. I don't have to estimate it. And finally, it's nice if I can find an active market for similar assets. So if I'm valuing the Fifth Avenue building, I looked at other buildings in Fifth Avenue that have sold recently. The downtown building, I look at buildings downtown. The more I can get, the closer I can get to these requirements, the easier it is to do sum of the parts valuation. So that's, it's easier to do asset-based valuation. So let's start with liquidation valuation. As I said, liquidation valuation happens because you have no choice. You have too much debt, you're forced into liquidation, you're called in to liquidate the assets. So normally what people do is they take the assets and they put a number on each of them. You'd be surprised at how often liquidation valuation, people just use book values, as if you're going to get the book values back. But even if you valued each asset separately, here's the second problem you're going to face in liquidation valuation. If everybody knows you're desperate to sell assets, what's going to happen when you try to sell those assets? You're not going to get fair value. You're going to get 20%, 15% below. So with liquidation valuation, one of the challenges you face is, hey, I know what the values of the assets are if I sold them in a fair marketplace, but because I have to sell them in a hurry, how much of a discount would I have to apply to get it? And the reality is you're not even doing intrinsic valuation anymore. It has to be all pricing. Who cares what the intrinsic value is? You have to sell these assets in the marketplace today. So much of liquidation valuation is going to be pricing with a discount attached to it. How many of you are planning to go into accounting or accounting-based valuation or interviewing with accounting firms for jobs? No? Nobody? Come on. Somebody must be. Ernst & Young. No? Okay. Good. I've saved you. Right? Or somebody saved you along the way. But as I said, the big move in accounting is fair value accounting. Fair value accounting basically means you're trying to take balance sheet items and reflect them at fair values. So about 10 years ago, the accountants, you know, they were writing the rules for fair value accounting. They met in a panel in New York City. And I got a call from the panel. So this was a GAAP meeting in New York City, a panel with hearings. they said, would you be willing to come in and talk to us about what we're planning to do in fair value accounting? I said, are you sure you've got the right guy? Because I don't have nice things to say about you. Are you sure you want me to come in and talk to you? They said, no, come in and talk to you. Just be on your best behavior. I said, okay, I'll show up. So I said, before I show up, can you send me the rules that you're writing to cover fair value accounting, what you plan to do? And they sent me this rule called FAS 157. That's still the governing rule for how fair value accounting is structured. So I'm going to read you what I saw in FAS 157, and then I'm going to ask you a question based on it. So in FAS 157, here's what accountants were asked to do. They were asked to assess numbers for assets based on what market participants would be willing to pay today in an arm's length transaction. That's exactly the words used in the original rule. So what market participants will be willing to pay today in an arm's length transaction? If you read that description, is your mission a value mission or a pricing mission? Are accountants asking you to put a price on the asset or a value on the asset based on that reading? What market participants will pay? That's a pricing mission, right? So I wrote back and said, why do you guys call it fair value accounting? It looks like fair price accounting to me. And that, in fact, has been my quarrel with accounting, is calling it fair value accounting misses the point. This is fair price accounting. There's nothing wrong with fair price accounting, but it's definitely nothing to do with valuation. The problem, though, is they still think that it's fair value accounting. So here's what they're requiring accountants to do. They're requiring accountants to come up with a fair price for the assets, but then do a discounted cash flow valuation to back the number. Do you see the internal contradiction here? I'm telling people to attach a price to an asset. What should I be asking them to use as tools to get to a price? When we wanted to price assets the last 3 or 4 weeks, we've been talking about pricing. What do? We used a multiple and comparables. If you're going to do fair price accounting, that's what I want to see to back up the numbers, not a discounted cash flow model. But the state of accounting practice now is accountants are asked to do a fair pricing of assets and then do a discounted cash flow valuation to justify the pricing. So if you're an accountant, I'm putting you in an impossible position. Especially when you're pricing assets where there's no discounted cash flow model that gets you remotely close to that pricing. A few weeks ago, I got a call from the accountants who are auditing. They're not even auditing. You know, many of the mutual fund companies now, if they take positions in private companies like Uber or Lyft, are required to revalue their holdings every 6 months or a year. So it's required by law, by rules. So every 6 months or a year, they call in the accountant. The accountants come in. They take the Uber investment you made 2 years ago, and they try to put a number on that Uber investment, looking at the rule. So let's say Fidelity invested in Uber 2 years ago when the pricing was $32 billion. It's 2 years later. The most recent investment in Uber priced the company at about $70 billion. That's about 2 months ago. If you're the accountant attaching a number to the Uber investment that Fidelity has, what's the number you have to come close to? If your admission is what market participants will pay today, you've got to come up with a number close to $70 billion, right? So what? So they come up with a number close to $70 billion, and then they try to build a discounted cash flow model to get Uber to be worth $70 billion. And they very quickly realize that everything they've been taught about DCF is starting to break apart. They can't even get close. In fact, the accountants who called me, in their DCF model, they could not get the value past $3 or $4 billion. And part of the reason was they had a very constricted view of growth rates and margins. But they had a DCF value of $4 billion, and they had to come up with $70 billion. So I get a call from the accountant saying, we're desperate. What can we do? I said, I can tell you some tricks you can do to get the $4 billion to $70 billion, which means you're reverse engineering to get to the $70 billion. You're doing a kabuki DCF. Remember we talked about kabuki DCFs? You want to get to $70 billion, you can go through the motions. Oh, I'm doing cash flows now. I'm coming up with a discount rate now. And the reality is you know where this is ending. You're going to end up at $70 billion. Or you can try to be honest and say this has nothing to do with the DCF. The most you can get is $4 billion. But your job for us was to price this holding, not to value it. And based on what Lyft is being priced at, which is $7.5 billion as of right now, or based on what other people paid for Uber 2 months ago, $70 billion is what we're going to attach. So if I could change the way accountants approach this process, first, I'd rename fair value, fair price accounting. And second, the only tool I will ask you to justify a number is multiples and comparables, because that's what your job requires. So the next time somebody talks about fair value accounting, stop them before they get too carried away and say, let's be real. This is fair price accounting. Let's talk about the pricing process, not the value process. Which brings me to my third and final reason for doing asset-based valuation, which is sum of the parts valuation. Now, why might you want to do this? You could be a passive investor and you want to buy a cheap stock, and what you do is you find a stock where the stock is trading at well below the sum of its parts. And what you're hoping for is somewhere along the way, the next year, the next 2 years, the next 5 years, markets are going to wake up and say, you know what, we made a mistake, and push up the price. The other is you're an activist investor. You're buying this company to actually break it up into its parts, whether it be Sony or whether it be Disney or any of the other companies. So rather than talk about this in the abstract, I'm going to take an actual company, a multi-business company, and show you how to do a sum-of-the-parts assessment of the company. The company I'm going to use is a company called United Technologies. Have you heard of this? It's like a poor man's GE. Basically, it's a company that's like GE. It's a conglomerate, but not in as many businesses. Okay? I didn't want to do GE because I'd have to fill in 3 pages just with the data, so this will keep it compact. United Technologies is in 6 very different businesses, and I've listed them all up. I mean, they're by division. The Carrier division does refrigeration systems. Pratt & Whitney is a defense contractor. Otis does the elevators, so it's a construction company. UTC Fire and Security is a security company. Hamilton Sunstrand is a manufacturing company, and Sikorsky makes those helicopters, those massive helicopters, is an aircraft company. 6 different businesses, all part of the company. Why did I pick United Technologies? Because they actually provide very rich information on the individual pieces. Remember, we need that to value the pieces. So they gave me revenues and EBITDA and pre-tax operating income, CapEx, depreciation, total assets. In other words, I get a breakdown by business that I usually don't get with most of the companies. So I pulled this right off the 10K. So here's my job. I have to convert this raw data into a number where I can put a number on each piece. If I wanted to price these 6 businesses, what would I need to do? Go find comparable companies in each business, see what they're trading for, and apply them. Let's be very simplistic. Let's say our first try is we want to price these different businesses. And you're going to do it with, this is what I call a back-of-the-envelope pricing. Basically, you take each business, you take the median multiple in each business. Let's say it's EV to EBITDA, and you decide to pick that because you can use it for all 6 businesses. There's the EV to EBITDA for the sector. You multiply each business's EBITDA by the average for the sector, and you come up with an estimated enterprise value for each of the 6 businesses. You add them all up. The value you get is $61.7 billion. 95% of the time, when equity research analysts say they've done a sum of the parts valuation of a company, this is all they've done. They've taken a multiple, they've applied it. Usually EV to EBITDA to the 6 businesses. They come up with the pricing and they add them all up. Tell me what I could be missing by doing this. All I've done is taken each business's EBITDA, applied an EV to EBITDA based on the sector, and come up with an estimated value. What could I be missing? So I'm taking Sikorsky, I'm comparing to the aircraft business, and I'm applying a multiple. Could Sikorsky be much more, have a higher margin than the rest of the sector? Sure, right? It could be that Otis actually has much more stable earnings than the rest of the sector. By applying an average, I'm doing what we talked about at the very start of pricing, which is apply the average and then move on. And with pricing, what do we do to make our pricing more sophisticated? We ran regressions, right, of a multiple against the variable to see if we could improve our pricing. So that's what I did as my next step. I took each sector. I tried to find the multiple that worked best in that sector by trying 4 or 5 multiples until I said, this is the highest R-squared. And the R-squareds actually that I got are reflected here. So these are the multiples I ended up with for my 6 businesses as my best multiples. And I'm basing it purely on the R-squared. So I think I tried 5 multiples for each sector, price, earnings, EBITDA, and these, and the final, the multiples you see listed there are the multiples that gave me the highest R-squared. I find, you know, when you're especially when you're valuing a multi-business company, that it's nice if you can do enterprise value for all six businesses because it makes your life easier. Because we use PE for one and EV to EBITDA for the other, you can still get around, but it's a lot more work. So they're all enterprise value multiples. But in two of the businesses, I used a multiple of capital. In two of the businesses, I used multiples of revenues. In two, I've used a multiple of EBITDA. And it's done purely because they have the highest R-square. And not only that, I ran a regression against margins or tax rate, whatever the variables were. So basically, I've done what I did for a single company within each business. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take these regressions, plug in the numbers for each of United Technologies businesses into the regressions, and come up with a predicted multiple for each business. So essentially, I'm taking each business, using the sector regression I ran, plugging in the numbers, and I get a predicted multiple for each business. So rather than use the average EV to EBITDA for each sector, you now get this predicted EV to EBITDA based on what makes my business different. What you see in the last column is my estimated pricing for each business based on these regressions. What was my value when I just applied a simple average? Do you remember? $61.6 billion. When I adjust for the fact that United Technologies seems to have higher margins and higher returns on capital or higher growth than the typical companies in these businesses, the value that I get for United Technologies, or the pricing I get for United Technologies, because I'm still staying in a pricing framework, is $74.3 billion. That's a pretty substantial change from the $61.6 billion. I'm going to argue that if you ask me to price United Technologies, that this is a much better pricing than just applying a multiple based on the average for the sector. So if you ask me to price United Technologies, this is what I would do. Let's say I wanted to value United Technologies as a sum of the parts. What would I need to do? What are the three numbers I need to value business? I need cash flows, I need growth, and I need risk in the form of a cost of capital, right? So I know what I need to do. I need to estimate each of those, and that's basically what you're going to see in the next step is I'm going to try to value each of these six businesses from scratch. So first, I compute a cost of capital by each business. Why am I able to do this? I mean, I can't run a regression of Sikorsky against the market and get a beta. Why can't I? It's not a standalone business. It's part of United Technologies. But because I use a bottom-up beta based on the businesses you're in, I can value a piece of a business. I can value GE Capital as a standalone business. So what you see here are bottom-up estimates of betas, debt ratios, and cost of capital. So I get a cost of capital for each of the six businesses. And they're very different. Right? To get the cash flows, here's what I had to do. I had to estimate what they were reinvesting in each business. And here, because they gave me CapEx and depreciation by business, I was actually able to estimate a return on capital and a reinvestment rate for each of the six businesses. If I paused right there and asked you what United Technologies' star business was, could you tell me? What's the definition of star business? It's a huge return on capital. In this case, you're going to see that, you know, if you look at, you know, Sikorsky has, you know, maybe its return on capital is not as good, huge reinvestment rates. It's going to have a high growth. But if you look at cross returns on capital, Otis has a return on capital of 35.71%. Based on the return on capital, the star business for United Technologies is Otis, and its dog business, if you can name it as such, is its UTC Fire and Security, which has a return on capital of 6.03%. If you're a consultant and you're called into a company, tell me what businesses create or destroy value. This is the way you build up to it, is you break the company down by business and you build up to those fundamentals. So at the end of the process, I have a return on capital and a reinvestment rate for each business. How does that help me? What's my expected growth rate? It's return on capital times reinvestment rate. So when I do my growth rates, you can see how the growth rates vary across the businesses. And when I did my valuation, I was not stuck with using one DCF model for the entire company. I could actually pick and choose with each one whether I wanted to use 5 years of growth, 10 years of growth, or stable growth. So I have six businesses, and in UTC Fire and Security, I valued as a mature company. There's nothing here, no growth to be had. But the other companies, I gave 5 years of growth or 10 years of growth to come up with the value for the company. So essentially what I'm doing is taking each business that United Technologies is in and building a discounted cash flow model just as I would for a full company. So here's what the numbers finally look like. When I did my DCF valuation, present value, free cash flow, the terminal value, in my last column, I have my discounted cash flow valuations of each of the six businesses. The sum of those values that I get is $80.25 billion. Let me review again what the three numbers were. When I just did a pricing based on just the average, I got $66 billion. When I repriced them using regressions, I got $74 billion. When I do a DCF value, I'm getting a value of about $80 billion. Pricing and value can give you very different answers. I'll tell you the one loose end that I had here was I valued each of these businesses based on the cash flow of each business. But United Technologies as a company has this centralized headquarters with an expense in the most recent year of $408 million. So that's a G&A cost that wasn't allocated to any of the six businesses. And if you're deciding to buy United Technologies and break it up into six pieces, you can take two views of this $408 million. The cynical view is headquarters does nothing. We'll shut it down. We'll save ourselves the entire $408 million cost. That's very cynical and probably very unrealistic. If you become six separate businesses, what's going to happen? I would expect this G&A cost to go to some of these businesses, right? It's not like people in headquarters just sit around and do nothing. That's a cynical view. They are doing things that service the six businesses. So that $408 million in costs is part of the valuation. It's a negative cash flow. So what I do is I take the $408 million. I get a tax benefit because it's an expense. And I take a present value. That $4.587 billion is like the present value of the cost of keeping a centralized headquarters. I subtract that from my $80.25 billion. I get a value of the operating assets based on my DCF of $75.6 billion. So here's what I have. My DCF value net of that cost is $75.6 billion. My DCF value using a pricing and a regression is $74 billion. DCF value using a price is $71 billion. My DCF value, if I just use the averages, is $66 billion. And all of them are higher than the $52 billion, which was the market price at the time I did this analysis. I actually bought United based on this assessment. Nobody's broken the company up yet, but I don't need it to be broken up. I need the market to correct its mistakes, and essentially it's a different way of thinking about valuation. It requires more work, and it does require access to that additional information. In the case of United, I was able to get. So if you're valuing a multi-business company, you can try this. It's worth trying. It might not work for you because you might not have the information. So you're valuing Amazon. You could value Amazon Retail, Amazon Cloud Computing, and Amazon Entertainment is three separate businesses. The problem is Amazon is very opaque about the way they report numbers for these three businesses, so you're going to run into some roadblocks. But you can take any company and value it based on its pieces. With Tesla, given all the stories about it being in the automobile business and the battery business, you could value it as two separate businesses. The only problem is the costs are often shared, and there might be potential cross revenues across the two businesses. So you can already start experimenting and asking, when is this going to work on a company and when is this going to be really difficult to do? Okay. Any questions? So let's close off today by talking about valuing private businesses. When you value private, how many of you are valuing private business? I know at least a few people are valuing private businesses. Okay, you're valuing a private business, right? Is it a family business, or is it a friend's business, or is it? Okay. It's a hypothetical made-up business or a real business? It's a real business. Okay. So, but I want to talk about the challenges of valuing private businesses, because this is what's going to make you really popular at Thanksgiving. So you sit at the dinner, you say, I can value a business for you. Don't say that unless you actually can. So I'm going to give you the tools to value a private business. Here are the problems you're going to face when you value a private business. The first is you have no market value for the company, right? Because it's not publicly traded. You think, so what? Think of how many inputs are market value-based. When you do cost of capital, if your beta is based on a regression, you need market prices. The weights for debt and equity in the cost of capital are supposed to be market value weights. If you have options outstanding, you have to price them based on market price. So there are all these inputs in DCF valuation which are market value-based. Here's the second problem. When you're done with the evaluation, the first number you check is the market price. And if your number is way off, you know you've screwed up. When you value private companies, that crutch is gone. You value a private company, you have no idea whether that number is reasonable within bounds of reason. There's nothing to compare it to. So that's the first thing you're going to... You don't know what you're missing until you lose it. So when I take market price away from you when you value a company, you'll be amazed at how much more vulnerable you feel about your valuation because you have nothing to check it against. So that's the first problem. The second is, when you start estimating the cash flows, you're taught to go into financial statements and start building the numbers. You still have to do that with private companies with the following caveats. The first is, most private companies, you're going to get a much shorter history than public companies. Not all of them. Some private companies have been around a long time. But you might get 15, 20, instead of getting 15 or 20 years of data, you might have only 3 or 4 years of data. The second is, if you think there are differences in accounting standards across public companies, you should see how different those accounting standards are in private businesses. I remember about a decade ago, there was somebody in this class who decided to value her mom's flower shop, because her mom owned a flower shop, and she said, I want to help my mom, I want to value the flower shop. And about 5 weeks into the semester, she comes in a complete panic. She said, I have to change company. I said, what happened? You had a fight with your mom? She said, no, I went and asked my mom for financials, and she took me into a room which was covered with Post-it notes. Because here's what she did in her accounting. She had a small room with walls of Post-it notes. On one, she had a revenue Post-it notes. Every time she sold something, she'd write the number on a Post-it note and stick it on one wall. Every time she had an expense, she'd write it on a different colored Post-it note, post it on a different wall. At the end of the year, I guess she pulled all the Post-it notes off, gave it to her accountant to come up with the income statement. I don't know where Post-it note accounting fits in with GAAP accounting and IFRS, but she said, I can't do this. So if you think that accounting can be informal, it can be really informal with private businesses. The third is, there is this mixing of the personal and the business expense at private businesses. It's true in any business, but it's more egregious at private businesses. Like what? That business car that sits outside the office magically seems to leave at like 3:45 every day, just as the school lets out to pick up kids from school. That home office that you use for the business seems to have dogs running through it all the time and all kinds of other stuff happening, like somebody's cooking something in the home office, intermingling with the person. And there are all these people in private businesses where you're not sure what they... I call this the George Costanza effect. Remember in Seinfeld, in all those seasons you watch Seinfeld, I never quite figured out what George did. You remember what his official title was? He worked for the Yankees. He was the assistant equipment manager. I never saw him handle equipment. I think there was one episode where actually he replaced the Yankees uniforms with polyester or something, and disaster ensued. But other than that, all you saw was him talking to the back of Seinfeld's head. A lot of George Costanzas at private companies. What does he do? I don't know. He's the same last name as the owner, but he seemed to walk around all the time. And finally, in many private businesses, and this is a real problem, the owner spends all his time in the business, but there's no salary that he collects from the business. You know why? Because he gets to keep whatever. If you own a restaurant, you own a diner, you don't have to pay yourself a salary, because at the end of the process, whatever's left over is yours. That can become a problem if you're buying the diner from that person based on income statements. So we're going to talk about those four. So here's the first thing to recognize when you look at a private company valuation. If you ask me to value a private company, and I still remember about 15 years ago, you know, sitting in my office, this lady wonders, and maybe I'll have the valuation up there somewhere in the next few pages. She wonders and she says, you know, I own a candy company, you know, and I want to get a valuation, and I heard you do valuation, can you help me out? And I said, why do you want a value for your candy company? She said, what do you mean? I said, are you just curious about your value? Are you getting a value because you want to do a transaction? Are you getting a value because you're going to get taxed on it? She said, does it matter? I said, it does. You have to tell me. She said, I have to do a transaction. I'm planning to sell the business. I said, okay. I said, who do you plan to sell the business to? She said, what do you mean? I said, are you selling it to another individual? Is it a company? She said, you have a lot of questions. I said, before I value a company, I need to know the motive for your valuation, who you plan to sell the business to, because with private company valuation, the value attached to the business can actually be different depending on the motive for the valuation and who the potential buyer is. And that's what makes private company valuation so much messier than public company valuation. When I value Tesla, I don't have to think about who am I selling the stock to. You just value Tesla as a company and you hope for a market clearing price. With private companies, motive matters. So when you think about private company valuation, it's not just in private businesses. It could be in public companies for a division of a company when you want to do a spin-off. So this is a skill that is worth having even if you don't own a private business. So I'm going to go through four different scenarios with private company valuations, starting with the most difficult one. The most difficult private company valuation is when you have one individual selling a business to another individual. I'll give you a classic example that's played out every day all through this country. You're a doctor or a dentist. You built up a practice over time. This happened in my town a couple of years ago. This guy's been around, you know, he does children's braces, lucrative business. He's got this client base, and he's bored out of his wits. So he's got to 60. He's made enough money. He's trying to sell his dental business. He's trying to sell it to another dentist. Private-to-private transaction. Most difficult valuation of all when both sides are private individuals. So I'm going to start with that, private-to-private transactions. Second, I'm going to talk about private companies, private businesses selling off to public companies. So you're a candy company, you're selling yourself to Hershey's. Valuation is going to change, private to public. The third is I want to talk about private to IPO, where a private company goes public, like Snap. And finally, I want to talk about private companies that approach venture capitalists for money and how that valuation can be different from the first three. So let's start with private-to-private transactions and look at what makes them so messy. The first problem you're going to run into with private company transactions or private-to-private transactions is neither the buyer nor the seller is going to be diversified. Let me take the example in my town. The dentist who's selling his business, 90% of his wealth is that business. He doesn't have a diversified portfolio. And the dentist who's buying this practice is even worse off because he's taking the rest of his savings and buying this business. So neither the buyer nor the seller is diversified. He's saying, who cares? It's going to come back and matter when we talk about discount rates. Second, once you buy a private business, changing your mind can be very expensive. You know what I mean by changing your mind? You buy a publicly traded stock, and you make a mistake, you can sell it back. You can lose because you have a bid-ask spread, but it's tiny, especially with a liquid stock. With a private business, you buy the private business and you change your mind, it can be very expensive getting out of this process because it's a much more illiquid investment. And there's a third problem. The dentist who's selling his business, you know, he's got a great client base. He's got hundreds of kids who come in every week for their braces to be checked. And I mean hundreds. I mean, this guy is, you know, should be worth a lot. He sells the business to another dentist. New dentist has come in. New week opens up. Kids start coming in. They look at this new dentist and say, who the hell are you? Kids don't talk like that, but the parents say, who the hell are you? I'm your new dentist. I don't trust the new dentist stuff. I'm pulling my kid out. Unless you don't like your kids, they torture the kid a little bit more, pull his teeth out, you know, put some. But the reality is that you can't just pass the business on, because if you sell the business, it might be that you're such a key part of this business that if you leave, half your business goes out. It's called a key person discount. And especially with private company valuations, it can be a significant part of your value. So we have to deal with the lack of diversification. We have to deal with the lack of liquidity. And we have to deal with the fact that the person running the business is so critical that if he or she leaves, half the business goes with them. So let's start by setting up an example. So let's assume that you decide you want to buy a restaurant. Why have you been watching too much of the Food Network? You say, this sounds exciting. I want to buy a restaurant. Okay? So you take the rest of your savings. You quit your job, and you try to buy the restaurant. I own this restaurant. I'm a French chef. This is an upscale restaurant. You're going to buy the restaurant from me. So you're the buyer. You were working in investment banking for about 3 months before you quit, and you decide to do that. You've taken your entire savings. You're going to buy this restaurant. And I give you my financial statements. In my financial statements, here's what I'm reporting. About $1.2 million in revenues in the most recent year and $400,000 in pre-tax operating profit. Looks like I'm making a fair amount of money. The firm has no conventional debt, but it has lease commitments outstanding because I lease the restaurant space. It's $120,000 every year for the next 12 years. So I have a 12-year lease. Last year, I made $400,000 in operating income and $1.2 million in revenue. You're trying to figure out how much you should pay for my restaurant. You ready? Let's get the process started. First step is you want to figure out how much I'm actually making on my restaurant. So let's go through the financials to make sure that you've got every I dotted and every T crossed. So if you look at the last 3 years, this is what the numbers look like. You know, my revenues are growing. Last year, I had $1.2 million in revenues. So there's my operating income and my net income. It looks like a pretty profitable restaurant. The only problem is I don't draw a salary because I own the restaurant. I'm a French chef. You're going to buy the restaurant. So tomorrow, what's going to happen? I'm going to be gone, and you're going to be the new chef. How much French food can you cook? Well, if you can cook, if you can be a chef, that's fine. But if you're not a chef and you can't cook food, you can buy the restaurant. It looks profitable. But tomorrow, to keep this restaurant going, what do you have to do? You have to hire a chef and pay the chef whatever the salary would be. So already you can see that the stated income is not going to be the actual income because you have to adjust for the fact that the owner didn't charge himself a salary. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to redo last year's financials with the salary built into the process, and that's going to become the basis for my cash flows when I do my valuation. So file that away. I'll come back and use these numbers to come up with my income, but you can already see the seeds of a problem. One is that I'm not charging myself a salary. The other is I'm treating lease expenses as operating expenses. And remember what we said about leases? They're really dead. I should be cleaning up for that as well. Let's now talk about getting a discount rate. To get a discount rate for a publicly traded company, what do? We came up with a beta for the equity. We built up to a cost of equity. We came up with a cost of debt. And we built up to a cost of capital, weighted by market value weights. And we used that to discount the cash flows to value the operating assets. So let's try that. As a private business, though, remember, there is no regression beta to use. So you will have to come up with more creative ways of estimating beta, and you're not going to be, and the buyer here is not diversified. So here's the first thing I did. I acted like this was a public company, and I got a beta for the public company. And how did I do that? I used a bottom-up beta. I went and looked at 75 publicly traded restaurants, and I came up with a beta for those restaurants. It's a bottom-up beta, 0.86. And then I said, but this is an upscale French restaurant. These restaurants that I got as publicly traded restaurants were restaurants like McDonald's and Burger King. I mean, these are not the restaurants I would think of as comparable restaurants if I'm trying to build up a beta to an upscale restaurant. So I actually replaced my restaurant beta with a beta for high-end retailers. You're saying, but it's not a retail firm? What am I saying? I'm essentially saying when those retailers do well, lots of people are going to come into my restaurant. So I'm actually redefining my comparable firm because of what kind of restaurant I am. So my beta, if this were a publicly traded high-end restaurant, would be based on that unlevered beta 1.18. But here's the problem. When I use beta, I'm looking at only the risk in the company that cannot be diversified away, right? We'd say that up front. And with public companies, the argument I used was investors can diversify away the rest of the risk. Investors like, you know, not you and I, but State Street and Fidelity and BlackRock. So I'm going to focus only on the risk that I cannot diversify when captured with the beta. What did I just say about the buyer? The buyer here is going to take his entire wealth and buy this restaurant. He is going to be the exact opposite of diversified. He's going to be entirely invested in this one company. So I'm going to ask you an intuitive question. If you're a publicly, if you're a diversified investor looking at this company, the beta you see is 1.18, reflecting the risk you cannot diversify with. If you're a private investor looking at this company, let's say you're not diversified, would you see more risk in this company or less risk than a diversified investor? More. And what's the other risk you're going to see? The risk that you normally have diversified away, you were now going to say, I'm not going to be able to diversify it away because I've got all my money in the company, right? In fact, here's the way I think about it. I think of it almost like an algebra problem. Let's say beta measures market risk. And let's say the number of units of market risk in a company is 20 units. If I'm a diversified investor, I stop right there. But let's say you're not a diversified investor. You're exposed not just to the 20 units of market risk, but to the remaining 80 units of firm-specific risk. My job is to bring into your discount rate the rest of the risk. So what is that going to do? Instead of using a beta 1.18, I should be using a beta that's much higher to capture the rest of the risk. And your cost of equity is therefore going to be much higher than a diversified investor would demand in this company. The question then becomes, how do you come up with that adjustment to your beta? I don't know whether you remember when I showed you the Bloomberg beta pages for your companies, in addition to a beta, I showed you an R-squared for each company. R-squared captures how much of the risk in your stock comes from the market. I actually keep track of those R-squareds by sector, and I use it to actually compute what I call a total beta. Let me back up. The beta 1.18 that I got was actually the beta for publicly traded investors looking at this company. When I looked at the R-squareds across restaurants, the R-squared that I got was about 25%. I'm sorry, across retailers, I got 25%. You take the square root of the R-squared, you get the correlation coefficient. Basically, the correlation coefficient here is about 50%. Here's the way to think about it. Half the risk in these companies is market risk, and it's captured with a beta 1.18. And if I were diversified, I'd stop there. But because I'm not diversified, I'm exposing myself to the other half of the risk as well. So I'm going to increase my beta to bring in the rest of that risk. A total beta is designed to capture the total risk in a company, not just the market risk. And that total risk is captured with a beta of 2.36. That's all I'm going to do, is I'm going to replace the 1.18 beta with the total beta. That total beta is what I'm going to use to come up with my levered beta and my cost of equity. And to get my debt to equity ratios, I'm going to keep it simple. I'm going to say, look, I don't know what the market debt and equity are for this company. I'm going to use the industry average, which is 14.33%, and I'm going to use that to come up with a beta and a cost of equity of 14.5%. So the difference between what I do here in a public company is primarily in adjusting the beta for the rest of the risk, using the total beta, which pushes up my cost of equity for private businesses, and holding all else constant, it's also going to push up my cost of capital. So my cost of equity is going to be 14.5%, reflecting the fact that I'm now incorporating into my equity that risk that I normally would have diversified away. In fact, to complete the process, I use that higher cost of equity, I use a cost of debt based on a synthetic rating, just like I would for a public company. Everything else in this process looks just like for a public company. I end up with a cost of capital of 13.25%. That is going to be the discount rate I use on my cash flows to value this private business. So that's, to get to a discount rate takes a lot more work with a private company. And you can see because the buyer, it's not because the seller is not diversified. It's because the buyer is not diversified. I have to adjust the beta. Adjusting the beta pushes up my cost of equity and pushes up my cost of capital for a private business. So now I revisited my financial statements and I cleaned them up. First, I put in a expense for a chef. So basically you'd see a $150,000 jump in my expenses. That's me hiring the French chef to take over the job. Second, I move the leases from operating to cap to financial, basically just like I would for a public company. I've essentially come up with an adjusted operating income for this company of $370 million. That's going to become the basis for my cash flows, not the reported operating income of what, $450 or whatever the chef gave as the original operating income. This is the cleaned up operating income for the company. And capitalizing the leases gives me debt of $928 million. So at this stage, I have something that looks just like a public company, right? I have operating income, I have a cost of capital, I have a reinvestment rate. I can do everything I do for a public company. And that's how I completed the process. Okay? And before I do that, though, one final thing. In this case, I'm buying a restaurant run by a French chef. And for whatever reason, the high-end restaurants, the name of the chef matters, right? So if you buy a restaurant with a big name chef and then you become the chef or you hire a chef, half the restaurant might be empty. And this is more art than science, figuring out how much of your revenues you will lose if the chef leaves. In this case, I'm going to assume that I'm going to lose 20% of my patrons if the chef leaves. What does that mean? The $370,000 I got as operating income, I'm going to knock off 20% saying, if this guy leaves, I'm going to get lower operating income and a lower value. Let's play a little game. Let's say you're the chef selling this business, and you know that I'm knocking down 20% because you're leaving. That's bad for you, right? Because it's going to lower your valuation. Are there things you can do to reduce the impact? What could you do? In fact, in the dental and the medical businesses, when one dentist sells to a new dentist or one doctor sells to a new doctor, often the old dentist and the old doctor will stay on for a couple of years. Even if they do nothing, they'll just hang around. Not because they want to, but what are they trying to do? They're essentially trying to create that cushion where clients come in or, you know, in this case, you know, patients come in. They see you still around. They do this because it means the key person discount can be smaller. So when you see that happening, part of what people are trying to do is get a higher value for the business, saying, I'll stay around a year or two just to make sure you don't lose too many patients. Because there is a real impact you have from having, in this case, I'm going to knock down the value of this business by about 20% because I'm worried about losing customers. And when that French chef, when you buy the business finally and he leaves, you know the final thing you have to make sure he does? Is sign a contract that he's not going to start a restaurant next door. Okay? Because that's your worst case scenario, is you pay this big price for a restaurant and he takes the money and buys the next storefront and becomes your competition. But something you would never think about with public companies. With private businesses, you have to think through the consequences. So I'm almost there. Okay? Just as with public companies, I wrap up the loose ends by saying, if I want this business to grow, I have to reinvest. In this case, the return on capital in the business was about 20%. I expected about a 2% growth rate, you know, stable growth. But to grow 2% with a 20% return on capital means you've got to reinvest about 10%. So basically, every year you're going to see a reinvestment of 10% of my after-tax operating income. Why? Because I want to grow. So if I bring all of these numbers together, here's what my valuation looks like. My adjusted operating income is $296,000. Let me review where I got there. I started with the financials you gave me, but then I cleaned up. I cleaned up for the fact that I have to pay for a chef, I have to capitalize leases, and that I'm going to lose 20% of my operating income because the chef leaves. I used a tax rate of 40% because that's the tax rate I'm going to be facing on this income. I used a cost of capital of 13.25% because I'm not diversified. I've got to bring in all the risk into that cost of capital. A growth rate of 2%, which is an assumption, but the 10% reinvestment rate is based on that growth rate. You plug the numbers in, 296,000 grows out at 2% after taxes, after reinvestment, 13.25% cost of capital minus a growth rate gives me a value for the operating business of about $1.4 million. If you subtract out the lease commitment that you have here, which you have to get to the value of equity, the value that you get for the equity is $521,000. As a restaurant owner, and I show you this number, let's say you're disappointed that it's so low. After all, you made $1.2 million revenues last year, $400,000 operating income. I'm telling you your equity is worth only $521,000. Think of why it's low. It's low because you're leaving and 20% of the operating income walks out with you. It's low because you're selling to somebody who's not diversified. There are ways to fix that, right? Find a better buyer. You can find a buyer who's more diversified. That'll increase your value. And if you agree to stay on a year or two, that could increase your value. So if you say, what can I do to increase my value from 521,000 to a higher number? I can very easily tell you what you need to do. You might not be willing to do those things or able to do those things. But there's a reason why private company valuations tend to be so much lower than public company valuations. And you can see that play out when you start thinking about discount rates. And this is even before I've talked about liquidity, which is going to be the final blow here, lowering your value even more. You can already see why your valuations are going to start to get lower and lower as you look at private businesses. So if you really want to try this out, pick a friend, offer to help a friend value a business. If you have a family business, try your hand out. You know, what's the worst that can happen? You can get thrown out by a family. That's never going to happen. Just if you're going to be biased, bias it upwards. It's after all your family business. But try it out because it'll force you to think about things that you take for granted in public companies. Things like, you know, financial statements that are always there, numbers that you can trust. Many family businesses, especially if these are businesses that have been run with the incentive of paying as little in taxes as possible, you might have to get the secret books out. You know the ones I'm talking about, the ones they don't show to anybody but family? And say, we really made a million. We can't tell that because we'll have to pay taxes on that. Don't use those books, use these ones. It's actually an interesting challenge because a private company, for, you know, as long as you run it, you want to report as little in income as possible. right? Because you don't pay taxes. But when you want to try to sell it, you want to tell the person that you really made a lot more money. I don't know how you get from I'm not making any money to the tax guy to I'm making a lot of money to the potential buyer. But it's an interesting dance to see. I mean, it happens every time you see a private company valuation. And it's actually, it makes, I think valuing private business is more interesting than valuing public companies simply for that reason. Any questions? So I'm going to stop there. On Monday we will continue with private companies. We'll finish packet one. Oh, I'm sorry, packet two. If you bought packet two in the bookstore, it's packets two and three. If you're printing off your own packets, please print off packet three for next week because we'll be into the final packet for the class.
You're giving away more shares than you should. The effect on the values of your existing company, on your existing shareholders, will therefore be negative. Conversely, a high pricing can push up your DCF value because you issue shares at that over. You might be able to invest in or acquire other companies for way less than you should be paid because you're using overpriced currency. There can be a pricing feedback, but only through that external capital increase. So it can happen. It can happen, and it can be potentially dangerous, especially for companies that are growing fast, right? Because then you can have the feedback.
You can
actually show them your DCF valuation, right? Because then you'd have to bring in the mispricing into your reinvestment. So what you'll have to do is take a reinvestment and adjust your reinvestment for the mispricing. You reinvest, you push your reinvestment down by using overpriced currency, or you push it up by using money price. To show up through your cash flows and your obligations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Remember what I said at the start, right? There are things you can't do. You can't estimate market value of debt. You can't estimate market value of options. You have to do the best you can with the data you have. Why are you doing all of this? Are you doing this to get a return on capital using a regression or something?
If I'm using like an input number,
right.
So I want to get the return on capital. Since you've given us like the operating leases.
Are you adjusting your EV to EBITDA for all of those things? If you're adjusting it there, then you've got to adjust. If you don't adjust, if you're not adjusting the left-hand side, you can't adjust on the right-hand side, right? So if you're going to capitalize leases and capitalize R&D to compute EV to EBITDA, then of course you've got to adjust. If you're not doing it on the EV to EBITDA, then you shouldn't be adjusted. Are you keeping return on capital equal to the cost of capital? Or are you letting return on capital be up? Because your cost of capital changes over time. It will be sensitive because it depends on what you think steady state will look like for Tesla.
But there's only the
margin you have on the steady state cost of capital is not large. You can't make it 4%, you can't make it 12%.
Yeah.
Right? The median cost of capital for U.S. companies is about 7, for a global company is about 8. So when you think about what a reasonable cost of capital is, you're ending up in that very small band between 7 and maybe 8%. You can't have 15, you can't have 12, you can't even have 10 because the company is a mature company.
But it's like decreasing over time, so it's like about, so I got a cost of capital about 6.8% for Tesla, and then for the last year, since it's like becoming a mature company, so I'm reducing it over time.
To what?
To about like 6.5% or, but if I use 6%, and it's like the value.
I think 6.5 is already too low because you're already below the median. Maybe you should increase it in steady state.
But But isn't, like, won't it become cheaper for them to get capital when they mature?
No, not necessarily. It depends on what when you start. It looks like you're giving them a starting cost of capital, which is already below the median.
Yeah.
That becomes my parameter. So I don't know what went into your initial cost of capital, because it's maybe the risk you're worried about in Tesla is diversifiable risk, and there's no effect on lowering the cost of capital.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're welcome. Within the industry do it, it's there to pick the buy and sells within the industry. Your job is to go across industries. So you can pick different multiples across for each sector, right? You have seven sectors.
How do you compare across, let's say you get
for each industry? You can get a multiple, it's a comparison of percentage difference, right? What does it matter which industry it is? Whether you use EV to have a dollar, you need to invest in capital, you need to sell. At the end of the process, what do? You look at the percentage difference, right? So I think the percentage difference, you can still compare. The trade-off, though, is as you start breaking into sectors, it is true you get more refined ways of picking different multiples. But the trade-off is you have much smaller sample sizes. So if you need to run a regression with 37 companies, and so you got to ask yourself, which is giving me a better measure of five cheap or five expensive stocks? You're breaking the sample size down into seven smaller samples and running regression within each one. Or is it running one big regression across a bigger sample? So it's not a slam dunk that going to smaller focused sectors is going to give you a better price, right? Because you're trading off one benefit for a cost. The benefit is you get more, you can pick a different multiple for each sector. The cost is that you now have smaller samples, which means your regressions are going to have a lot less predictive power. You could in one regression, you'd have to do it in the form of some variable you throw into a multiple regression that captures a sector component. So you might not be able to throw seven dummy variables, but you might say, look, it's not the seven sectors that worry us, it's technology versus the rest of the market, the Chinese companies versus the rest of the market. So you could throw in dummy variables into your big regression to capture what you think are a particular, so if you get